We never know where life will lead us or what may hinder us along the way. But while every day can feel like one big question mark, it doesn't have to. With the right insights, strategies, and solutions from Western and Southern Financial Group, together we can look ahead to leave the unknown behind.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PLL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo back here with Sam Monson. It is July and we're having all sorts of fun, Sam. And somebody presented a great topic for us to cover today.
Yeah, well, a couple of different people were building this whole show off emails that have come in.
And that's what it's all about. We want more emails.
That could be you. If you're thinking, hey, I've got a great topic for a podcast, but I never hear it anywhere, send it in to us. We'll steal it.
It could be like, all right, compare NFL players to 1980s wrestlers or something like that. That would be a great show. Just saying, that'd be a suggestion. It might make it, it might not.
Be a suggestion, yeah.
But on today's show,
if you want it, the email is nflpodcast@pff.com. To be fair, we'll steal the idea and credit you. You know, we're not just going to rip it off and be like, hey, I came up with this great idea over the weekend while I was doing nothing in particular with the PFF emails. So yeah, send us emails. Also, we've had a lot of great ideas come in terms of what we should do for the next charity drive. So we'll be doing minor league Sam dressed up as Steve at some point when you drag all your crap back from Massachusetts. Then we'll have to come up with the next thing to do. We've had people giving us ideas of the charity. We've also had people come up with ideas of like the forfeit, the thing that we should be doing.
A lot of ones I don't have any interest in.
Yeah, well, there's a few that require a lot of setup. And look, this is not a setup intensive kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Now, I can see why you'd be led astray, given that it's taken us to like 2 months for you to get a bunch of clothes together. But this is not like the smaller amount of setup involved in this, the more likely it is that we're going to do it. Also, the lower the chance of a necessary trip to the emergency room, the higher the chance.
Yeah, so
we'll
like
do it.
The extreme hot peppers are probably
yeah.
Probably
like I was kind of all on board for that, but people keep sending in like stories about how they ate a ghost pepper and like how to develop a stomach ulcer. Like, you know those charts where it's like the Scoville heat index. We're up here, it's like Carolina Reaper. Down here, it's like a bell pepper, right? And just various gradations of all the peppers.
I'll eat some bells.
Somebody needs to draw like a dotted line where stomach ulcer is, right? I'll eat anything below the dotted line. Anything above the dotted line, I'm out. I'm not developing a chronic stomach ulcer for a giggle on the PFF NFL podcast. I want the podcast to be successful and to make, you know, our millions and millions of listeners happening, to make the company money. Not to the point where I'm going to develop a stomach ulcer over it.
If you want to make the listeners happy, you're supposed to tell them what's coming up on the show. Or I set you up to tell them what was happening. And
we had housekeeping to do. Send us emails was the upshot.
If you want to host, you can host. But can we just go ahead?
I'm just saying.
What's on the show today?
Send us emails. That's what I was
saying. NFL podcast at pff.com.
Right. On the show today, we have a listener that sent in a very well-crafted thought exercise, I guess. Are the Detroit Lions, and therefore Dan Campbell, actually secret geniuses? So that'll be interesting to read through and answer. And then after that, it's the PFF Hall of Fame. Now, that's not the corporate one that we have for like people in the company that you and I are apparently members of.
When somebody said you should have a PFF Hall of Fame, I saw the opening sentence. I was like, oh, we already do.
Yeah, we already got that. No.
We already do.
No. So this is like if PFF was in charge of our own Hall of Fame for NFL players that played during the PFF era, who would make it? So we'll get into that later, and we've got some rules involved because, you know, rules make the world go around, Steve. So let's get into it.
All right. So let's start with this Lions question.
Yes.
Okay. Wait. I do have one thing before you get into it. Mm-hmm. Our college football preview magazine is incredible.
Yeah.
And I think they just need proper credit for it. 600 plus pages. It is a part, because we've had a lot of questions about this. It is a part. We have two different subscriptions here. You can get any PFF college subscription or your PFF Edge subscription. It is all there. It's really just $7.99 with the college subscription, but it is a part of your Edge. It is awesome. And, you know, I've mentioned before, I like my Phil Steele. I like having the hard copy, but you're getting a lot of stuff in the PFF college magazine you just don't get from the traditional Phil Steele magazine, which I love. Big fan of Phil Steele. But this is a fraction of the price of your Phil Steele magazine. And incredible information. The guys did awesome work, and every team got some love in there.
You're just crapping all over Phil Steele the last couple of episodes.
No, I'm a big fan of Phil.
I was talking to a neighbor the other day, and one of the weirdnesses about America is that you guys, when it comes to advertising, there's no like rules about how you can't like crap on your competitor, right? So ads over here, it's like,
There's rules about that?
Yeah, everywhere else. There's ads for like Budweiser, right? But the ad about Budweiser is usually spent telling you how Michelob or Miller sucks, right? Whereas everywhere else, whatever, Michelob?
Yeah.
Okay, sucks. Whereas everywhere else, the ad would be focused on the product you're actually selling, not the competitor for whom you want to
said was, I love my Phil Steele magazine.
You can tell that you've been brought up in this American system of advertising.
No, because
your promo, your ad is all about how this is way better than that Phil Steele thing that you may have had before.
That's how wrestling used to work.
Never
mentioned the competition until they broke that barrier, changed the whole thing. All right, let's get into this here. So the Dan Campbell is a genius. Do you want to read this?
Okay.
Read this email, Michael Yule.
Good. Thank you. I assume it's Yule. There's no like acute on the E or
Yule,
anything.
As in Yuletide.
Yes. Anyway. All right, let's get ready here. Hi, Sam and Steve. I've edited this, by the way, because there was a bit at the start about how, you know, I love the show, blah, blah. You're not supposed to read those things out. It makes you look a bit, you know,
well,
conceited.
We're just scratching the surface of professionalism.
Well, that's true. So it's not true. But B, also, you're not supposed to read out the bit about how great you are, because it sounds conceited when you're reading it from somebody else.
I've cut
it out. As the title suggests, I think the Lions draft strategy may actually be one of the more underrated strategies in team building. You often note on the podcast that linemen, particularly O-line, can take 2 to 3 years to develop to their full potential, with skill positions on offense taking the least amount of time to develop, and quarterbacks being somewhere in the middle, and sometimes hitting the ground running, like Justin Herbert. For receivers, you know, think Justin Jefferson, etc. Therefore, if linemen take a few years to reach their full potential, are the Lions actually geniuses for building in the trenches first this year? Sewell, Onwuzurike, McNeil, hypothetically attacking quarterback and the defensive secondary next year and rounding out with skill position heavy draft in year three. Of course, they wouldn't solely target those positions every year, but that's where the emphasis would lie. Therefore, in 3 years' time, the Lions could have an offense and defensive line that's fully come into its own, a quarterback that's starting to piece it all together, a defensive secondary that's had time to adjust to the NFL, and now offensive skill position talent that can be productive right away. Additionally, this could give them flexibility with the cap, as generally often cheaper positions, interior defensive line, are paid first, allowing them to front load any second contracts and save cap space for the more expensive quarterback and skill position to extend later down the road. This does, of course, assume that the Lions will have a decent hit rate on draft prospects, which, given the high number of value picks they have in the future, isn't completely unreasonable. And they're competent with free agent signings, as well as having solid coaching staff that can develop talent, perhaps the biggest if in this whole situation. So my question to you both would be, do you view this as a valid team building scenario, or are there too many external variables and scenarios that could completely derail this draft and team building strategy? Thanks for reading this essay of an email, and keep up the good podcasting. I left that one in, not by, you know, intent.
You just had forgot.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. Glasgow's PFF number one fan. That's Glasgow, Graham? Not Glasgow.
Graham Glasgow?
No, not Glasgow's. Glasgow's.
Glasgow. Wow. I thought it was Graham Glasgow's top fan.
No.
It's confusing. Anyway, basic premise is building in the trenches if you're the Lions, smart move or not. That's the email in a nutshell.
Well, smart move or not to build in the trenches first, because the time scale for development is different. So even if the numbers would say, hey, secondary receiving talent, passing game, it's more important, are you actually better off starting off with the thing that takes the longest to develop?
Yes. I think Yes, I do. I think it's an astute question. And I do think that the Lions are positioned to have that long-term view because the new regime signed long-term contracts.
Right. It is, they have the time to build it whatever way they want to build it. They're going to have 2-3 years, theoretically.
There is a philosophy in the NFL, which is build in the trenches, right? And we have tended to not tried to debunk that. Our data has tended to debunk that, which and it would say, actually, in today's NFL, win on the perimeter. Win at wide receiver, win at cornerback and all that stuff, as long as the trenches aren't terrible. So you don't win in the trenches. You have a decent foundation in the trenches, but you really win on the perimeter. You really win in the pass game. So a team trying to rebuild with, you know, a coach who's on a 3- and 4-year contract, you might not say, hey, let's just attack the trenches right now. I really think this Lions strategy makes sense because they can have this long-term view because they have signed a long-term deals. They gutted the roster. The roster was already somewhat gutted so anyway. And yeah, I think there's a lot to like here. And plus just, you know, trading Matthew Stafford for multiple first round picks is also just beautiful team building. That's what they should have done.
The variable, I think, is the secondary and cornerbacks, because I think cornerback takes a similar amount of time usually to offense and defensive linemen in terms of when you're going to get the best player. You know, look at what happened to almost all of the rookies last season. Those guys just got torched. So, you know, you expect them year two, year three to be the years where you get the best play. So, you know, with the same strategy, you probably want to be drafting corners at the same time as your defensive and offensive linemen. Now, to be fair to Detroit, they kind of did that, right? They grabbed Melifonwu in this draft. Also, you can probably look at the guys they've had recently and say there's a salvage job to be done on the likes of Jeffrey Okuda in particular, and say, okay, this wasn't our regime, but this is a guy who's a year away from being one of the best draft prospects at corner to come along in years. We like him. We think he can be part of this rebuilding prospect. And let's say let's add him to this draft. Let's see, he's a guy we're bringing in as a draft pick. I think you can maybe look similarly on Oruwariye. I think he's another young player that has shown some talent and might be part of a better secondary in the future in a different scheme than he was under the old one. So you can kind of look at it and say, well, they've sort of done that already with the corners that they've had brought in. And then my second thing is, I'd be interested to know how conscious it is, right? Like, if the strategy is, we have an acute awareness of the different time scales involved in different position groups and how they take to transition to the NFL, then I'm all on board for saying this is a really smart way of doing it, because that's an intelligent way to be looking at this problem, whether or not it works out, right? I applaud the process at that point. If it's just NFL in the 1980s says you build from the trenches, and that's what we're doing because we're Dan Campbell and we can't bite.
Can't give Dan Campbell and the crew any credit.
I'm making no judgment one way or the other. I'm saying that these are two different alternatives. Yeah. One, that they have this sophisticated understanding of different variables attached here and they've elected to go in this direction. I would say whether or not it works out, that is smart process. If it's the other way, which is just, hey, you build a football team from the trenches, then no, that's not smart process. You know what I mean? That fits with all the other stuff that's just old school meatheadness, and that's just not a smart way of doing anything. So I guess I would like to know which of those is the truth, because I think one of them is a lot closer to genius than the other, put it that way.
I think if you're looking, so the thing I'll be interested to see, just to be clear, like, let's reset where the Lions roster is right now. From an offensive line perspective, probably a top 10 caliber unit. Like, they've got top 5 potential, depending on how quickly first round pick Penei Sewell does actually hit the ground running. Taylor Decker at left tackle is very good. Penei Sewell's going to play right tackle. Jonah Jackson was a rookie last year, was a little up and down. Frank Ragnow just signed the biggest deal in history for a center, right? So he's a top 3 caliber center from what we've seen the last year and a half. So that's a bunch of really good spots. And then Big V, Vaitai, who's a better guard than a tackle, will kick into guard. I think on paper, it looks like, hey, guard might be a question mark there, but the offensive line across the board is looking pretty solid.
But Jonah Jackson would be a good case study for how this works, right? We really liked him as a prospect coming out, didn't have a good rookie year. If he takes a big step forward in year two and an even bigger one in year three, that's the reasoning behind this, right? It's like right now, left guard looks like a major question mark, but there's reasons to think that Jonah Jackson might answer that question. It'll just take him 2 or 3 years.
And then when you look at the receiving core, it's just the pass game in general, Jared Goff, no matter where Jared Goff was from a production standpoint, I think you'd always say he's a mid-tier quarterback. He's in that range. He's QB 14 to 23. Like, he's somewhere in that range in any given season, right? And sometimes you get a little bit above that. Jared Goff throwing to Breshad Perriman and Tyrell Williams, Geronimo Allison, Quintez Cephas. I mean, that's not the greatest group of pass catchers. TJ Hawkinson's a good, solid tight end. But I think that's the position next offseason and beyond in the draft, free agency, whatever it is, they're going to have to, attack is the perimeter there. Defense, you mentioned some of the pieces that they have there. But I think what you'd be looking at is – potentially, like, a good case scenario is them becoming the Colts in a couple of years, right? Which is the Colts, and Chris Ballard came in and reshaped that entire roster. They've had one of the best offensive lines over the last couple of years. They've had to figure out quarterback in part because of it, because of Andrew Luck's retirement and, stitching it together with the Philip Rivers, now investing in Carson Wentz. But I think you'll have a similar proxy for where the Lions might want to go. Are they going to be sitting here with this very good offensive line in a couple of years? And the thing I've been critical of the Colts of is the perimeter, is the receivers. They've done a good job schematically protecting their corners defensively, who aren't great on paper. But I think the thing that's holding the Colts back is that receiver position, right? So I think there needs to be a point in this Lions team building strategy where it's like, okay, we've done, trenches are looking good. We got to go all in and try to get 3 and 4 deep at receiver and pass catcher, because that's how you win in today's NFL.
The other question would be, what are the ramifications for your team overall in terms of being good at one spot at the expense of being abysmal at another, versus taking a bit of a scattergun approach and trying to get incrementally better across the board? Like, Detroit loaded up on the trenches and grabbed Melifonwu a corner, added virtually nothing to the pass game. So consequently, you've got an offensive line that should be pretty good, but now you've got Jared Goff throwing to Perriman, Tyrell Williams, Geronimo Allison, Quintez Cephas, Amon-Ra St. Brown. Like, it's bad, right? In theory, like, on paper, that could be a catastrophically anemic passing attack. Now, would you have been better to say, we will, instead of one of these big body defensive linemen or, an off, like Jamar Chase, right? We'll grab an offensive tackle next year, but we'll grab Jamar Chase, whatever, like that kind of thing. I know he was drafted by the Bengals, but
he was gone, but yeah, hypothetically.
That kind of decision making, right? Go for a star receiver early, get one less big body on the offense or the defensive line, grab that guy next year. And therefore, we might have something in the pass game to tread water this year while we improve across the board. I'm not sure. Are there consequences to that, to essentially deliberately be as bad as they look like they're going to be from a pass game standpoint while they build everything else?
Well, the reason why I brought up the Colts is I'm trying to envision what the Lions are going to look like this year, which is, how many teams recently have had that quote-unquote top 10 offensive line, which I think the Lions are capable of, but haven't had a great pass game or haven't had great pass catchers and have been a really one-sided team, right? So the reason why you would say you can't just win in the trenches is because you have teams like every Carson Wentz Eagles team, besides the 2017 team, I've said this a million times on this podcast, right? They've always had a good offensive line. They've had 1 or 2 years with a good group of actual pass catchers for Carson Wentz. Early Raiders with Derek Carr, had a really good offensive line. But until they had Amari Cooper and a couple other, complementary threats, they weren't moving the ball offensively. Derek Carr had a really good offensive line as a rookie, and they were not good. There was one other example I had off the top of my head, but there are other examples of teams that have just a really good, solid offensive line, but not necessarily the pass catchers to do anything. So ultimately, though, it does come down to the Lions. What do they do at quarterback, right? So that's the other comparison I make here is when Kyle Shanahan, John Lynch took over in San Francisco, 6-year contracts for those guys. And I remember thinking at the time, they have the time to build this roster, to build this foundation before they figure out quarterback. And they waited half a season. They passed on Mitchell Trubisky, Deshaun Watson, and Patrick Mahomes, for whatever that's worth. And then waited half a season, traded for Jimmy Garoppolo, and that was their investment. That was their guy as they, you know, added some other pieces. But it felt like they had time before they had to, like, really attack the quarterback position, which the Lions also do.
It's a little bit like that idea that you bring up every now and again, which is you don't want to breed, like, a losing culture, right? And because it's hard to shake out of, even once you get the talent in place, that you should be better than that. So does skewing all the way to the trenches do that by proxy, because now you have no passing game and you can't win in today's NFL with no passing game? Plus, you've essentially thrown a quarterback out there as, like, a genuine sacrificial lamb for the season. It's like, all right, we have a quarterback. Yeah, he's Jared Goff, and he's going to get murdered because he's got nobody to throw to, but he's there. And then next year we'll find a real quarterback, and we'll move. Like, it just, I don't know. It feels like you can definitely paint the picture that it's a smart way of building things in abstract terms, but there are, it feels, negative sides to going out there with basically the worst passing game in the NFL on paper.
There is potential. I mean, there is potential with all those guys too. So this is the Jets receiving core last year this time, because Breshad Perryman's there.
Yeah.
But we've seen flashes from Breshad Perryman when healthy. Tyrell Williams hasn't played a lot of football since 2018, but 15 plus yards per reception guy when he's on the field. We're talking about guys. Perryman and Tyrell Williams are both good number threes, which makes them okay if you give them a lot of volume as number two receivers. You know, maybe they're okay. that's just where they are. And right. Then, you know, Hawkinson at tight end, and trying to talk myself into it.
Yeah, good luck with that. I'm not, no, it's not going to go well.
I think the biggest thing, what we're going to see this year, is more information on Jared Goff.
What is it? Like, is it? Because the guy has no shot.
No, what because information if he does, is it? Because if he elevates this unit.
Yeah, if he achieves the impossible, it says something about him that's different to what we think now. If every other scenario comes out,
but it could be.
Though.
So let's just say, this is similar. This is a similar supporting cast to, say, Sam Darnold's Jets. It's a better offensive line, no doubt. But if Jared Goff goes out there and he puts up Sam Darnold production, I think you learn stuff about Sam Darnold. You learn stuff about
the whole point
players
about,
in that potential middle tier of quarterbacks.
No, the whole point about Darnold right now is that he's this perpetual question mark, because the guys that love him will say, it's all the Jets. He got Adam Gase. He never had a shot. Now the Panthers can trade all these picks, and now we'll really see Sam Darnold, right? You never learn anything about the player as long as he's in that scenario. So the only way that Jared Goff can show anything different or give you more information on Jared Goff is if he comes out here and suddenly looks like Joe Montana despite no receivers to throw to, and you're like, okay, Goff is actually better than we gave him credit for. This is amazing. Look what's around him. He's turning these guys into stars for the Lions. If Goff goes out and does anything else, it taught us nothing, because you're like, well, he's got nobody to throw to. What did we expect to happen?
No, because
nobody
think
would look different in this.
If Goff, if this year Goff and Darnold switch spots in, like, the QB hierarchy, whatever, right? If you're ranking quarterbacks right now, say Goff is 20, Darnold's like 29, 30, 32, whatever it is. If they somehow switch and Goff looks like rookie year Goff, or he looks like Sam Darnold of the last couple of years, and Darnold, because he's got a Joe Brady in Carolina and he's got some really good pass catchers, and yeah, the offensive line's got some issues, but Darnold all of a sudden looks like 2017 Jared Goff. That was his second year. That was McVay's first year, and all of a sudden we're like, wow, look at this. Sean McVay works magic with Jared Goff. If Darnold does that this year, I think it just furthers this point of, like, the middle-tier quarterback, your success is only dependent, or not only, but is just so dependent on coach, receivers,
right, but
and environment.
It teaches you nothing about Jared Goff. Like, Goff can rank anywhere from, like, 18 to 40 this year in terms of quarterbacks.
I think it
would
say
you learn nothing about
just
him.
Then you would further the narrative that he is a Sean McVay product.
That's all people think anyway. That's why they, like, salary dumped him to get him off the roster.
Like, but if Goff puts up the same production this year as he did with the Rams, you would say, okay, that's Jared Goff. That's who he is. And he did it in a lesser situation in Detroit. That would be telling.
I'm not sure what we're learning about Jared. Like, all the data that we can get from Jared Goff this year seems irrelevant.
I just love all this AB analysis. We got Stafford going to to play with McVay. We have Goff going to on paper a poor situation. We have Darnold going to a better situation. Some of that movement. I know quarterback movement is cool. Tom Brady going to Tampa Bay. Like, you learn more about these guys when you get them into different situations. So, ultimately, I think it's a pretty good strategy by the Lions. I wouldn't say it's closet genius. I would say it's a good team-building strategy given where the roster is and where they're looking to go.
I just want to know if it's deliberate. Can we get – we got Detroit beat writers to listen to us. Somebody asked
Dan. Can we get
Campbell,
Mark Brunell on the horn?
Somebody asked the Lions decision-makers if this was a conscious team-building strategy based off information.
I will find out.
Or – if they just decided that smart teams win in the trenches because that's what we do here.
I can find toughness. Out, but I probably can't reveal my sources.
I don't care if you reveal your sources. I just want to know the information. I want somebody on the Lions beat to ask the Lions whether this was conscious or not.
I'll send some messages.
Okay.
PFF has partnered with Symbol, that's Simbull, the stock market for sports that allows you to trade sports teams like stocks and earn cash payouts when your teams win. Symbull has blended sports and the stock market to offer you a new way to invest in and profit off your favorite teams and the Lions. The MLB is in full swing for the rest of the summer, allowing you to earn daily cash payouts. And of course, the NFL. That's what you're listening to. This is where you want to invest. So keep an eye on all of the information during training camp to see your team's stock rise. Use promo code PFF and deposit $10 at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free PFF annual subscription. It's promo code PFF with a $10 deposit at symbol.app/PFF to earn a free annual subscription. All right, you want to get into this second part here, Sam?
Sure.
The PFF Hall of Fame. Again, not the internal one, not the one where you have a green jacket.
I don't have a jacket.
Well, I have
no jacket.
Them. I'm in...
You're... Jacket man?
I am in charge of finding some PFF green jackets.
Wow.
For us.
This is not something we should be
We should not be
the
talking
public.
On air here.
This
is,
looks
not,
ridiculous.
This is internal business only.
Yeah, thank God.
But look,
by the way, if
good
it's
companies
not,
do companies do a, they you have to find ways to acknowledge your best employees.
It's not written into a contract anywhere, but there's no way I'm ever appearing in public anywhere with one of these jackets on. Like, there's no photo that's going to circulate.
Oh, really?
Never happening.
When we
never.
Have that bet where we have to, like, make somebody, you know, make each other wear something, I'm going to make you wear your
I'm not doing it.
PFF Hall of Fame jacket.
Not happening.
You got to be proud of it. Like, the gold jackets you see running around the Super Bowl. You got to be proud of what you've earned.
Yeah.
You turned a startup into a
I don't think those are comparable
man.
Things. NFL Hall of Famer, PFF Hall of Famer. I don't think those are comparable levels of wear your jacket with pride out
it's,
in the streets.
It's similar. 10 years of hard work.
Also, they only do
something.
That like they only do that like at the Super Bowl, you know, when they have to go and like football conferences essentially.
Oh,
right?
I doubt it.
You find like I'll wear no. You I won't. Think
Barry Sanders wearing his gold jacket to like
he's not wearing
Trader
it to like Target.
Jones.
Down the street.
He's
just
going
grabs
to Whole Foods
him.
With his
no, he's not.
Gold jacket
Absolutely
on.
Not happening.
They all. Some of them are.
No, none of them
like
are.
Andre
That's the thing.
Reed. Andre Reed would wear it.
They're
everywhere.
Only wearing it to like, you know, public football events, like the Super Bowl ring. Like they sit in the, they sit in, like in the safe until they need to present a show on TV or whatever. And then the Super Bowl ring comes out. And it's like, yeah, look, I am champion.
All right, let's get to this PFF Hall of Fame. Get to the. Damian Bradbury gave the suggestion or question, what would a PFF Hall of Fame look like? And so PFF data goes back to 2006.
Yep.
The requirements we're looking at here is not just guys that are going to the Hall of Fame, not Tom Brady or Drew Brees or Peyton Manning or anything like that, but people whose career started during the PFF era. And this is not about are they going to the NFL Hall of Fame.
Well, not only that, but I think we should... I think we should strip out those players, right? Because there's a bunch of players that are obviously going to the Hall of Fame that were drafted during the PFF era and that we have their whole career. You know, Joe Thomas is going to walk in there as a first ballot Hall of Famer. Megatron is the PFF. Like, there's a bunch of those guys, Adrian Peterson, that were drafted during the PFF era that are obviously going to go to the Hall. And frankly, it's not a good discussion to be like, hey, PFF also thinks Joe Thomas was a really good player. I'm more interested in the guys that may not, probably won't, make the Hall of Fame, but you could make a good case that they should, for whom PFF has their entire career. And it got me thinking, we were talking to Andrew Whitworth on the last show. Well, I was, you were somewhere else. That Andrew Whitworth is one of those guys where we have his entire career, 15,000 snaps of playing time. And what Whitworth probably should be a pretty clear Hall of Famer.
Well, let's just set that criteria real quick before you transition to the actual names. Mm-hmm. So we're going to say, so it's people, Von Miller, J.J. Watt, we're saying Aaron Donald, we're saying let's forget those guys.
Yeah, any shoe-in for the actual Hall of Fame is not really up for discussion here.
Who are the guys that we highlighted during this era? Did you put Justin Smith on here?
No, because we don't have his whole career. So
we missed rule 05?
Number one.
When was he drafted? 04, 05?
Something like that, yeah. Don't make me look
it up. You missed Eric Weddle on your list here. I wrote at the bottom. It's okay. So we'll go through. Guys who entered the league in 2006 or later.
No, you're way off. Justin Smith was drafted in the fourth overall in 2001. We're way off.
Sorry.
Rule number one, 100% of his career must be captured by the PFF system. So no Tom Brady, for example, or Justin Smith. Guys who predated us. 2006 onward. 2006 draft onward. I said, look, stick to guys that are not going to be shoe-ins for the actual Hall of Fame. And then the last one is, let's also stick to guys that are either retired or, you know, about to be. Like Whitworth's, how long can he really go on? Look, the guy's 39 years old.
How are you going to...
It's got to come off at some point, right?
Are you going to call him out like that?
Look, he knows.
Our friend of the show.
He knows he's hanging on. He also said, look, you got 15,000 snaps. It's a nice round number.
You've either got to 20.
You've either got to call it a day right there or go all the way to 20. But anyway, let's stick to guys that are about done.
Go listen to the Whitworth interview on the last show. It's really good. All right, so let's go through it. PFF Hall of Fame, 2006 or later, not a shoe-in for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Andrew Whitworth is your first nomination.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he actually didn't inspire the idea since somebody emailed it in. Well, maybe he did. Maybe the person
you've been talking about this for a while, though, but you've been more thinking, like, could we help influence the Pro Football Hall of Fame for guys like Andrew Whitworth?
Yes. I mean, maybe the emailer wrote this in response to having listened to the Andrew Whitworth interview, so I can't actually claim that it wasn't inspired by this. But yeah, a guy like Whitworth, I think, is a perfect example where he has kind of been underrated for his entire career, down to, you know, being drafted as a guard slash tackle, not seen in the Joe Thomas kind of world as, hey, from day one, this guy is the perfect building block at left tackle. Whitworth had to earn it. He had to show people that he was capable of doing that. And then do it time after time after time. And, you know, unlike Joe Thomas, again, where it's like everyone just assumed he would be good right up until he hung him up, I think people have been waiting for Whitworth to fall off, right, and to not be as good as he has been, and to expect this is the beginning of the end. And he just keeps on defying Father Time and defying convention across the board. So I think Whitworth is a perfect example of a guy who probably is at that Hall of Fame level. And I don't know where his sort of overall Hall of Fame stock lies in the eyes of the people that vote for this kind of thing, but it feels like he's a significant distance from like a guy like Joe Thomas. And in terms of like PFF grade and data and all those kinds of things throughout their careers, he really isn't and shouldn't be.
Somewhat similar. Yeah, they're in the same range at least. Yeah, offensive line has always been one of those positions where it is – they haven't had numbers, right?
You've right, and a lot of these guys are offensive linemen. Like, as much as I think we've done a good job in terms of furthering the debate on this kind of stuff, I think the areas where we can still like highlight guys that have been career underrated is offensive line.
So Marshall Yanda is another guy that we've brought up a lot. What I was going to say, though, as far as like Hall of Fame credentials go, offensive line is usually just based off of perception and feel, or this guy crushed people, this guy entered the league and was a Pro Bowler. I mean, it's very much a, you know, like word of mouth type of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's where it always was.
Yeah, and Joe Thomas has always been,
and by the way,
up there.
If like Joe Thomas and Andrew Whitworth, I think their careers, their peaks were very similar, but even if there was more of a gap than there has been, at some point, longevity is a factor. It gets very difficult because I don't like longevity as... I don't like long... Like, if you're average for a really long period of time, in my opinion, there's no length of time you can be average that transforms you into something different. You know, like Frank Gore, right? Let's be honest, it's Frank Gore. Frank Gore could play for 47 years and it wouldn't change like how average he's been for those 47 years. See, just because he'd hung on for that, it doesn't turn that into something different.
I used to think a little differently though. Like when you, Kurt Warner was a guy whose peaks were absolutely incredible.
Yes.
Right? In from 99 to 01, best quarterback in the NFL. Like right. There wasn't a peer.
But how long would, so Andy Dalton couldn't play for a period of time that would transform Andy Dalton into a better quarterback than he has been.
No, but I think there's something to, like, Andy Dalton's not a good example because, yeah.
It's a perfect example.
There's no time where he looked like a Hall of Famer.
Exactly. My point in a nutshell.
But I think the other way, though, a guy like Kurt Warner, who played like a Hall of Famer essentially between 99 and 01, and then again between like 08 and 09.
Yeah.
Like those were the two times when he played like a Hall of Famer. If Kurt Warner had three or four more just normal seasons in there, to me that feels better. You know, like it feels like, oh, here's like this extended career where you're just saying, oh, he only had these 5 year.
To me,
this like 5 years of peaking.
The peaks are a qualification. I actually think almost the opposite, that if you saw 5 years of average play from a guy like that, it hurts their case more than it helps it. Like I've always made the argument that
this is the Eli case here.
No, it's actually like a Randy Moss, Torrey Holt, J.J. Watt kind of case, right? Like if Torrey Holt quit the league after 7 years, Torrey Holt would walk into the Hall of Fame. He didn't. He hung around for a while, and the back end was not great. So now everyone looks at his career, and they're like, well, it was this great start, but then it falls off, and now you compare him to Isaac Bruce and Chris Carter and all those other guys, and it didn't end up as good because the back end wasn't as nice. Whereas I think if he just walked off out of the game after 7 years, he'd have the best 7 year stretch of any player in NFL history. And he'd be like, that guy walks into the Hall of Fame. So my point with, so Kurt Warner, I think just reaches the threshold. Like peaks were amazing. He's a Hall of Fame player based off those alone, and we're done. My point though with Andy Dalton is that we always make that point, the Dalton line. If you're above the Dalton line, you're a pretty good quarterback. If you're not, you're looking for somebody else. Dalton could play, he's basically the definition of a bang average NFL quarterback. There's no length of time that he could play that would transform that rank average status into something just different.
But he's a
because
bad,
of longevity.
Nobody is, no, there's, Andy Dalton's a bad example. Matthew Stafford.
It's a perfect example.
Matthew Stafford is a better example. You take a guy who is good. Andy Dalton, you use the word average. In the grand scheme of the world, Andy Dalton's good. In the grand scheme of the NFL, he's average, right? Matthew Stafford, for the majority of his career, has been good. And top. He's probably QB 11 to 15
okay,
of his era.
Fine. Use so Matthew Stafford. There's
Matthew
no
Stafford
length of time that Stafford could play that turns good into great.
And there are enough. There's the handful of, you know, people on Twitter that would make that case.
That's why Stafford is
4 or 5 years away from Matthew Stafford having, and this is why the 17-game schedule, Sam, is. This is why you shouldn't want the 17-game schedule, because Matthew Stafford's going to have an extra, you know, 300, 400 passing yards every year now and all this stuff.
He's going to have the Peyton Manning records by the end of it all. Yeah, look, so Matthew Stafford, I don't love Stafford as an example because there are people that think he was better than he is anyway, which complicates it. But yes, there's no length of time that Matthew Stafford can play that turns his consistently pretty good play into something great. And that's my problem with longevity as a thing generally with the Hall of Fame, is that people use it as a force that transforms play into something better than it ever was just because he did it for a long period of time.
What if Matthew Stafford?
I don't get that. It doesn't have a transformative effect. But what I think it can do is have like a tie-breaking effect or maybe a boost to something that was already really good. So my point was going to be, look, Whitworth and Joe Thomas are actually really close in terms of peak, in terms of overall play for an extended period of time. But Joe Thomas called it a career after 10,821 snaps. Whitworth is at 15,000 and counting. There has to be something to that. That's like another 4,000 snaps.
There's something to being good for a longer period of time.
Right.
Good.
We're already Hall of Fame caliber.
But just for PFF terms, let's say 80s. Grading in the 80s for an extra 5, 6, 7 years means something. Grading average, high 60s, 70s, whatever, that you're saying that doesn't mean anything.
I think,
because Frank Gore is a different example than Andy Dalton. There was a point, there was never a point where Frank Gore was like the best running back in the league, but he was in the top five conversation
for like a year and a half.
For a lot of his career, I think he was probably in that top five conversation.
No, look at his, like, no. He really hasn't been.
I'm not going to defend Frank Gore's Hall of Fame credentials on here. No way.
Longevity can be a reason that it's like it should separate players that were already qualifying for the Hall of Fame, right? Like, guys that are, like, their career in isolation before you even factor in playing time, you're like, yeah, that guy was a Hall of Fame player. And then it's like, all right, but this guy did it for twice as long. That should mean something. But it shouldn't be like, well, this guy did it for twice as long, but was half the player that the other dude was, but he did it for twice as long, so that equals the same thing. Get the hell out of here. That's ridiculous.
What if Matthew Stafford has a two-year, because again, our perspective on Eli Manning is he had two peak seasons, and they weren't necessarily the two Super Bowl years. He had two Super Bowl runs. One of them was a peak season. 2011 and 12, Eli played like a top five caliber quarterback. What if Matthew Stafford has two of those here at the tail end of his career?
So
to this point, he has not been a Hall of Famer. Can you, in a two-year peak, and maybe the Rams go to a Super Bowl and the whole thing, or maybe they win one, is that enough to turn Matthew Stafford, who right now we're like, there's no way he's a Hall of Famer. There's no point in his career where he has looked like a Hall of Famer, except, you know, three times a year he kind of does. But he's never been a Hall of Famer, and then he has a two-, three-year peak right now. Does that make him a Hall of Famer?
I think that, well, put it this way, that would have a much stronger effect on his Hall of Fame case than 15 more years of good play.
15 more years, he'd be like 30 years old at that point. Matthew like Stafford never ages.
If Stafford has 15 more years grading at 75, I don't care. If Matthew Stafford has a three-game run where he looks like the best quarter, or three-season run rather, where he looks like the best quarterback in the NFL, absolutely that moves the needle more than that. Now, quarterback is more complicated because it's the most important position in the NFL. I could be convinced that Eli Manning has a Hall of Fame case based essentially off the back of a 10-game stretch that culminated in two Super Bowl wins, right? I'm sympathetic to that argument. I'm not necessarily sure that I buy into it, but I will at least entertain that case, and I'm not writing it off from the outset. So quarterback gets messy, but just generally, you need to have been that caliber of player for a while at some point. And some guys that get touted as a Hall of Famer have never been.
All right, let's go through some of the other offensive linemen on this list. You've got Nick Mangold down here.
Yeah, I don't. It's been a while now since Nick Mangold retired, and he retired kind of young. So I wonder if generally the perception is kind of souring on how good he was. But Nick Mangold was the best center in the NFL for his career.
He was the guy.
Yeah, he was. For his career, he was basically the best center in the NFL for the entirety of it.
He had 11,000 snaps.
Yeah, but it feels like the longer things go, you know, the more people have kind of forgotten about Nick Mangold.
Well, that's why we're here.
Sure.
To remind
people. I don't know. Maybe a lot of this is always like, I don't quite know where the, like, maybe Nick Mangold is an absolute shoe-in for the real Hall of Fame, and it's ridiculous even bringing his name up, but just threw it out there.
Nick Mangold's a good one. Marshall Yanda is the one that we cite all the time. And again, I don't know what the perception is realistically.
And I think Yanda's perception probably did rise to meet where we've had him, like, basically through the entire one. The one that's more interesting to me is Josh Sitton, because I'm pretty sure his didn't. And Sitton was the best pass-blocking guard in the NFL for basically his entire career. Like, he was the guy that first started to put out numbers where you're like, this is a glitch. Like, these are not normal numbers for an interior offensive lineman. He would be the guy that had like single digit pressures over a season. You know, most guards.
Like Rodney Hudson.
Yeah.
Be another name here.
But even Hudson at center, it's easier to put up single digit pressure numbers at center. Now, his were so single digit that it ends up in the same ballpark. But most guards are giving up 20 total pressures in a season. Sitton was giving up single digits multiple times in his career and was just never allowing pressure on the quarterback consistently. He was the gold standard. While Joe Thomas was the gold standard at pass blocking for left tackle, Sitton became that at guard, and I don't think he ever got the credit that he deserved for that.
The trouble there, I mean, with the real Hall of Fame is like, okay, who was the best pass protecting guard in the 90s, in the 80s, in this, you know, in whenever?
Yeah, nobody knows.
Nobody knows. And so there's no way to kind of compare that. Going back to Yanda really quick, Yanda, two seasons above 90 in PFF grading. never graded below 81.7 essentially. Never great. His entire page from 2007 to 19 is all green or blue.
Yeah, I remember some of that was playing right tackle.
That's my favorite part about Yanda. He, as a rookie tackle, was in Joe Thomas range as far as rookie grade. I mean, he came in and played right tackle before kicking into guard.
Yeah, he is one of the great what if stories in terms of, like, if the Ravens had just kept Yanda at right tackle, what would his career have looked like? Because you could be talking about, you know, the best right tackle of the last 20 years.
Like, so Quentin Nelson's grades are trending higher than this, like his, the beginning of his career. But this is Quentin Nelson type of stuff where Nelson has, I think, has the hype. Again, it's tough to perceive this, but Quentin Nelson definitely has the hype. Whereas Yanda, I don't know, he was just the guy who's doing it, and he's solid and whatever every single year, and grading really well. So Nick Mangold, Marshall Yanda, you got Joe Staley written down here as well. Another good solid tackle.
Staley might be a step below those guys, but his career leveled out to being, like, there's something to being consistently the top of the next tier down for your entire career. Now, look, I have a fairly harsh, strict interpretation of what a Hall of Fame should be. And for me, like, if that's your peak, you probably don't qualify. But that's not where the real Hall of Fame is. And if you spent your entire career as essentially the top of the second tier of your position, so at no point were you ever Joe Thomas, but you were always like the next guy, I think there's something to that. And that was where Joe Staley, you know, made his career, was being just this incredibly solid, very good. You know, our friends at the Athletic football show, Robert Mays and Nate Tice, they did a show of the Hall of the Very Good.
You know, did a whole show on that?
Right. The place where Frank Gore actually belongs, that kind of thing. Joe Staley,
you wouldn't even,
I guess,
debate that. You might not even put him in the very good. You'd put him in the Hall of Good.
Hall of pretty good.
Yeah. Hall of above
Hall of admirable. Average.
Hall of admirable. So the Hall of Average is Thomas Jones.
Yes.
There's somewhere between the Hall of Average and the Hall of Very Good.
The Hall of where Frank Gore, yeah, the Hall Gore of Admirable.
I would say high mediocrity.
No, it's bad. Like, here's the thing. There's a place for guys like that, and it's NFL.
There's not, actually.
No, there's not. Not the there's mediocrity, not the high mediocrity thing. There's a place for guys like that, and it's team ring of honors, right? Rings of honor.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you had a great career. You had a fantastic career. You've hung on, like, so incredibly long that it's blowing people's minds.
What if they bounce around,
it's
though?
A phenomenal career. You belong in somebody's ring of honor. You don't belong in the Hall of Fame because you were never actually that good. That good, the Hall of Fame good. It's a really high bar to hit, and you didn't hit it. And it doesn't matter because you had a great career anyway. Congratulations to you. Here's your, you know, whatever it is, your alumni pennant. Now, bye-bye. You can come back in a couple of years, and the 49ers will put you into their ring of honor. Great place to be. You're not a Hall of Famer. I just think we should embrace that more. You know, not everybody has to be a Hall of Famer. It's tough to do. You know that, Steve. You're a two-time Hall of Famer.
Two-time Hall of Famer.
It's a really tough gig to get into the whatever it is, East Massachusetts Hall of Fame.
UMass Lowell.
There you go.
Hall of Fame. Okay. I'm still, if you're in the UML athletic department, like, do some research here. Should probably be in that Hall of Fame too.
You're not in that one. Which one are you in?
I'm not in the UMass Lowell.
What are you? You're in the PFF Hall of Fame. I'm the North Reading Hall of Fame.
North Reading,
Hall of Fame.
North Reading High School Hall of Fame.
Okay.
And obviously.
Of course.
Yeah, I was right. All state in basketball.
So I'm just saying,
I was all conference. I was.
It's not easy to make a Hall of Fame.
It's not. So UMass Lowell, like, figure it out, guys. I don't donate enough money to the school,
problem, yeah,
obviously, but should probably be in the Hall of Fame for my exploits.
Yeah.
You know, uh-huh. College World Series, Division II, but you know, College World Series. Maybe it might have been the bacon, egg, and cheese, actually. That disqualified me.
There's like a sign on the office somewhere saying, look, this guy never makes it in because of this.
Black
of
mark on our record here as I got you know, free breakfast sandwich on the way to the World Series.
We can't draw attention to the violations of the past by putting you in the Hall of Fame.
I think the statute of limitations would it's a statute. I know. Yeah. But look, when you throw 125 pitches, come back on 2 days rest and throw another 100 in relief, 6 1/3 to get us to the World Series. I think that merits something.
I'm not the person you need to convince.
On 2 days rest, Sam, I put my career on the line.
Yeah.
For the Riverhawks.
Maybe that cost you your shot at the majors.
Yeah, my velocity was way down the next year. I was hurt. My draft year was not great. A little disappointing. My draft year.
Which one?
My junior year. That was like, that's like when you can make some money. That was a big one. Like high school, I never really had a chance.
Right.
But my junior year, like I was going to get drafted.
Yeah.
Until I didn't.
Until, yeah.
Yeah. Until I was, you know, I was more like, I was throwing high 80s instead.
You were going to make bank right up until nobody was interested.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So put that career on the line so the Riverhawks could go to the World Series. You know what I mean?
And do they appreciate it?
No.
No,
no they don't. We're sitting here
slightly.
20 years later.
Nothing.
Nothing. Huh. Where are you guys? Where are you guys?
Story.
Come on. Anyway, let's get it's July. That's why we can have some fun. Dwayne Brown, another name you put down here. Just the Hall of the Solid.
Right. Similar.
We need a solid
better
hall.
Than that,
he's
right?
Good.
Similar story to Joe Staley. Became this top tier of the next group down, you know, went to Seattle, transformed that offensive line, granted from like catastrophic to just not great, but made a real material impact and an obvious one right off the bat. Dwayne Brown has become one of the best tackles of his generation. Again, probably like not in the Whitworth, Joe Thomas, Marshall Yanda area, but right behind them.
Three centers to mention here too. I'll add Alex Mack in here.
Whew.
Alex Mack, Rodney Hudson, Jason Kelsey. They've pretty much been the standard at center at various points in the last 10 to 12 years, I'd say. Kelsey, awesome, undersized, mediocre hockey player, but undersized center who's just awesome zone run blocker.
Sounds scorer of one of the most hysterical goals that's ever been scored.
I mean, he's a natural goal scorer.
Natural, yeah.
Natural goal scorer. Just things happen. Go listen to that. When was that? Last show? Two shows ago?
At least two, maybe.
Listen to all of our shows. You'll hear the story on Jason Kelsey. Rodney Hudson, the guy that we've highlighted, he's the Josh Sitton of, you know, pass protecting centers.
Yeah, I mean, his numbers are stupid.
Right. So again, it's just compared to your peers, Rodney Hudson in a different world as far as pass pro goes. And then Alex Mack has kind of been just like a little bit of both. Again, zone block. He's been in the Shanahan scheme. He's been in a system that plays to his strengths really well. But Alex Mack has been the standard zone blocking center. Him and Jason Kelsey, I don't want to say the standard. They're both up there as far as run blocking centers go during the PFF era.
Yeah, I think there's a decent case for all those guys. And that probably rounds it out for offensive linemen.
Quick break to tell you about our friends over at Underdog Fantasy. If you like fantasy football and you like playing fantasy for money, you need to check out Underdog Fantasy. Underdog's got everything, including season-long and playoff best ball. Best ball is a season-long game where you draft a team like you normally do, but that's it. There's no in-season roster management. Underdog automatically selects your best performers each week, saving you loads of time. Go to Underdog Fantasy and deposit $10 using promo code PFF, and you get a free PFF Edge annual subscription. That's promo code PFF. Draft now at Underdog Fantasy. Does that mean you get the college football magazine for $10 plus everything else that comes with Edge?
Sounds like a good deal.
Yeah. Promo code PFF over at Underdog Fantasy. All right. Who else we got here? PFF Hall of Fame dating back to 2006. Not your slam dunk Pro Football Hall of Famers.
I think there's a few defensive linemen that are interesting discussions. Kyle Williams, Meatball. Hey, one of the best nicknames ever. But Kyle Williams, you know, defensive tackle slash just general interior lineman once they moved around fronts for the Buffalo Bills for years, was an incredibly good player. Again, a guy that never hit the Aaron Donald, J.J. Watt heights of like the best player in the NFL by a mile, but was always really, really good and a difference maker for the Bills inside. I think he has a legitimate, you know, PFF Hall of Fame case.
Usually with those guys, you need to have that one peak season, at least from a sack total standpoint, to like for like the league to be aware of how good you are. And I think, you know, Williams did have one season where he had 13 sacks by our numbers back in 2013. But yeah, he was a better player even before that, right? He was grading really well,
yeah.
Disruptive in the run game, pretty good pass rusher. As I look back at his career, though, I think our memory of him might be a little bit more positive than even his actual grading. He had a lot of good solid years, but was never in that elite group for the majority. It wasn't in the elite group for the majority of his career.
No, that's what I said. But I think he is a player that fits that mold of being just consistently a really positive disruptor every single year.
69 pressure season back in 2013.
Right. It's a lot back then.
How about the couple safeties that I listed at the bottom here? Harrison Smith. You listed.
I listed him, yeah.
And I added Eric Weddle.
Yeah.
So Weddle kind of has a Yanda-like story. I think it was 07 was his rookie season. He started out more as a slot corner. My favorite part of Eric Weddle is the versatility. As the NFL has leaned on versatile players more and more over the past decade plus, Eric Weddle is that guy, right? He could play free safety. He could play in the box. He played in the slot his rookie season.
I mean, one, they're legitimate, like, natural successors. Like, Harrison Smith was the natural successor to Eric Weddle in terms of that player. For their careers, the league had kind of split in half. You know, there was half the league playing that Legion of Boom style, single high free safety, strong safety, Cam Chancellor role. And the other half was playing the more split safety looks, the 2-4-6 coverages, where you need a safety that can do everything, can move around, can execute every assignment you want of them. That was Eric Weddle to start with. And then Harrison Smith took over as the prototype for that position. And obviously there was a transition or a crossover period where they were both playing, but like they were the natural one then version two.
Devin McCourty, you have on this list as well.
Yeah.
At safety. He entered the league at corner.
Yeah.
And in 2010.
Had a couple of good years at corner.
He was legit at corner. I mean, the story of McCourty's career is when the Patriots, we always talk about the Patriots, they play man coverage like crazy. That didn't actually happen until about 2012 when they got Aqib Talib. Back when in 2009, 10, 11, the Patriots were playing a ton of zone coverage, and that's where McCourty was excellent. Once they tried to play a lot of man in 2011, McCourty got torched, eventually moved to safety once Talib showed up, and he became just one of the better free safeties in the league. And we always describe, you know, Earl Thomas is on this list as well. Earl Thomas makes those incredible plays where it's like, wow, look at these five plays Earl Thomas makes that nobody else can make. McCourty doesn't have a ton of those on his film, but he's the guy that just doesn't make a ton of mistakes, always graded well, sure tackler, would make some plays on the ball, but just you don't see busted coverages when Devin McCourty is back there playing free safety.
And I think he's a big part of why that Patriots secondary was always kind of tied together and never, other than like a five-game stretch at the start of when Stephon Gilmore arrived.
2017, yeah. Yep.
They were almost always tight in terms of never busting coverages and no breakdowns of communication. Right. I think McCourty's a big part of that. There was a hiccup when Gilmore rocked up and they were busting a coverage every week. But other than that, they've always been extremely good at that. And I think a big part of that is McCourty.
So you put Earl Thomas on this list.
I did. I think, look, those peaks that you talked about in terms of Kurt Warner, I think are one way to get yourself into the Hall of Fame. Just incredible, even if it's a run where you were just the best guy in the NFL at your position. I think another way of getting in is the real Hall of Fame, people like to start talking about, can you tell the story of football without X? And the answer to that is always yes. It just depends how long your story is, right? Like, it's a stupid way of approaching this. But to me, I think there's something where if you were the reason behind like an entire schematic shift, that like you had an impact on the game that goes beyond just your PFF grade or your tackle numbers or your interception numbers.
Lawrence Taylor.
Yes. And I will make, and or, you know, Randy Moss when he rocked up, Bob Hayes is the reason that zone coverage was invented, right? Because the dude was maybe the fastest sprinter in the world and started running go routes. And you're like, you know, people like me, like, I can't run with that guy or in fact be within 10 yards of him when the ball arrives. We're going to have to do something other than man-to-man coverage. Like, if you did that, if you're a reason things like that happened, that should put you in the Hall of Fame because that impact is difficult to measure and it resonates. Earl Thomas, I will maintain, is the reason that the Legion of Boom, the biggest reason that the Legion of Boom was so dominant, because what he did allowed everything else to function. The fact that he could make plays on the ball from anywhere he lined up as the single high free safety, from being able to play that role closer to the line of scrimmage than anybody else that's ever tried it. Like, Thomas's impact, I think, just resonates beyond his overall level of play in a way that none of the other safeties on this list can make that case. I think you're going back to like an Ed Reed to find the last guy that had that kind of impact.
Yeah, I think with safety, if you look at the last era of football, however you want to define that, the last 15 plus years. Ed Reed, Troy Polamalu, that was the big debate.
Yeah.
Completely different players. That was the big debate
but
for a
same,
while.
I think same concept in terms of both those guys, their impact resonated and what they did allowed their defense to function.
And then Earl Thomas being that guy, right? Yeah. So the transition to Earl Thomas there. What about Richard Sherman? Do you think he's just a slam dunk for the Pro Football Hall of Fame?
I think he walks into the real Hall of Fame.
Couple other names here. We've used Chris Harris quite a bit as like the poster boy, poster child, whatever you want to say, for PFF grades, highlighting underrated players who aren't just good, but actually among the best at their position. Yeah. Chris Harris, the third highest grade of the decade of the 2010s, behind two surefire Hall of Famers, right? Darrell Revis and Richard Sherman. So Chris Harris might be the most obvious one here, where I don't think he's making the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but he's first ballot all PFF Hall of Fame here.
I like the two corners together. Chris Harris is a good addition, and then I like Casey Hayward as well. I think those two guys, massively underrated still. Now, I think we made a big deal or a big difference to their overall reputations and, you know, making them seen as better players than they would have been if they'd just been left to the hype machine working its magic. But I think both guys are still underrated for their careers. You're right. They're both up there in terms of overall grade for the decade. Casey Hayward still had one of the best rookie seasons we've ever seen from a cornerback statistically and in terms of PFF grade back in 2012, right, with the Packers, where he was a slot corner, putting up absurd numbers, like Revis-like numbers in terms of passer rating against those kinds of things. So those guys, I think, have both been incredible players, and neither of them gets the kind of respect, even that a guy like, you know, Patrick Peterson has had throughout his career.
Yeah, and both players, Hayward and Harris, to your point, have played in the slot, have played outside, and they generally haven't really seen a drop-off in performance when they've had to play different roles. And I think that was what impressed me most about both of them. Yeah. Like, there was a point where it's like, we've seen you do it in the slot. What's going to happen when you're outside? And both, you know, essentially stepped up and performed well.
Rookie year for Casey Hayward. PFF coverage grade of 91.6. So that's already insane. 500 coverage snaps. This is including the playoffs. Had 76 targets thrown his way. 43.4% of those were caught. Now, this is in the slot where a lot of catches are essentially gimmies, right? A completion rate of 43 in the slot is ridiculous. Passer rating of 30.4 into his coverage.
That's crazy.
Didn't allow a touchdown all year long. Had 6 picks and 12 pass breakups and a passer rating of 30. The famous number, the passer rating of throwing the ball into the dirt every play is 39.6. So he's almost 10 points lower targeting Casey Hayward as a rookie from the slot than it is just dumping the ball into the ground every play. The three greatest statistical seasons we've seen from a cornerback, that's one of them. Darrell Revis in 2009, the absurd greatest season we've seen. And then William Jackson III, 2017, where he put up Revis-like numbers on a smaller sample size and not quite, you know.
We need to do a whole show on Revis 09.
Right.
People need to remember.
But those are the three greatest stat seasons we've ever seen from a corner. And Casey Hayward did it as a rookie.
Oh, you already wrote Geno Atkins down. Yeah. Doubled up. Give me some other ones.
Brandon Graham. You have a...
I said I don't know about Brandon Graham just because of...
You don't like him because he's costing you lunch every year.
Yeah, but it'd be nice if he'd get 10 sacks again.
Right.
But are we doing that again this year?
Every year. But
no, I think...
Because it gets more likely that I win from here on.
I'm over. I'm over it.
But Brandon Graham's been one of the best pass rushers of his generation. He's never been Von Miller, but he's the Joe Staley of pass rushers, right? He's always been the best of the next tier down and never got the credit he deserves because he doesn't get 10 sacks a season.
Yeah, I agree. So there are some other interesting defensive names on this list, guys who were drafted between 06 and 12. And so they obviously had their entire career during the PFF era. Guys like Brandon Graham, 91.9 career pass rush grade for him. Cameron Wake, 93.7. Yeah. Pass rush grade during his career, was never a great run defender, and both guys played over 6,000 snaps. Wake and Graham, they're actually very similar from a grading.
Graham has
production
three
standpoint.
Seasons with a PFF grade above 90. He's got another one of 88.6. He's got 9 straight years with a PFF grade above 80. And the only years that he hadn't take that were essentially a lost season to injury and his rookie year. So, I mean, Brandon Graham's about as good as it gets for a guy that was never Von Miller.
So are we going to – the PFF Hall of Fame here, this isn't the PFF Hall of Very Good either.
No.
So I'm looking at, like, the highest graded defensive players, you know, in the PFF era who were, you know, drafted 06 to 12. There are some interesting, very good names. Calais Campbell, you wrote on this list. Campbell started out slow in his career and became
– not even slow, just not – like, he had all of his best play after 30.
Which is just very unlikely. I mean, that's incredible.
But it's not
and he's done it at multiple positions, and not the multiple alignments, like actually played three tech for the majority of seasons. He's played edge for the majority of seasons and played extremely well.
But it's not that the, like, the stuff before he turned 30 wasn't bad. It was just not, he just wasn't, like, arguably the best defensive lineman in the NFL other than Aaron Donald.
Cameron Jordan, similar career path, started out a little slow and then became a 90-plus caliber player for a few years. The great Brent Grimes. Don't forget, Grimes was just an excellent corner. We, you know, whatever we had to deal with his wife and getting attacked on social media like Grimes, everyone else did.
Grimes is also Grimes was also the poster child for, like, that undersized corner that can still hang outside. Like, NFL put up a tweet based off PFF data that said Tyler Lockett has never dropped a pass in the red zone, maybe, whatever it was. Anyway, the point was, teams should be analyzing Tyler Lockett for what is it about him that means a 5'10", 180-pound guy can thrive on the outside at the NFL level, because that's usually the thing, right? You find a 5'10", 180-pound wide receiver in college, and you're like, that guy's a slot player.
Right.
Brent Grimes is the same thing for cornerbacks. Like, you should look at Brent Grimes and you're like, how did this guy survive and thrive against guys that were 50 pounds bigger than him and, you know, several inches in height, length, all those kinds of things. Grimes was legit.
Yeah, so there are some other good names here for guys that are in that are in this mix. Cameron Hayward, you mentioned. Did we mention off air? Cameron Hayward has become one of the better interior defensive linemen for the Steelers. Fletcher Cox.
Cameron Hayward is on the Calais Campbell track of started playing like the best defensive lineman in the NFL.
Like year five. Donald,
right. When he turned 30. Yeah. Same thing, right? He's had four straight amazing seasons, I think.
How old is he?
34, he's not
that old. He is not that old.
He's pretty old.
You're way off here. I mean, Kyle Williams is only 38.
Right? He's 32. So,
he started.
And he's had the best two seasons of his career the last 2 years.
Maybe you're right.
He's like, if he continues another couple of years, he's in that ballpark as well.
Levante David, drafted in 2012.
Yeah.
And then how about the two 49ers linebackers, Patrick Willis and Navarro Bowman, both 90-plus career PFF grades. Patrick Willis probably goes to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was people see him as this Ray Lewis type. And
he was.
I mean, he played incredible football, but Bowman was like right there with him.
I think,
and they were as interchangeable as it gets as far as that old school 3-4 inside backers.
I think you can make a strong case for the following linebackers: Patrick Willis, Navarro Bowman, Bobby Wagner, Luke Kuechly, and Levante David.
By the way, is Bobby coming up at the end of the show here?
We've been told.
Full disclosure, we're Bobby recording will... early again, and we have a scheduled Bobby Wagner interview, potentially on this show.
As of now.
But I will learn from past mistakes. I will not tease it.
As of now, there is a Bobby Wagner interview scheduled to be recorded, which will be attached to this particular podcast.
And we want it to make sense. We wanted to have him at the tail end of the PFF 50 when he was number 8 overall. So we want to attach it to the PFF Hall of Fame, you know, episode here, where Bobby Wagner might be, he might get a green goldish jacket or whatever we decide come up with.
Now, I can't be held responsible for whether or not Bobby actually materializes this time. I'm just saying, as of now, with all the information that I currently have,
I refuse to tease it.
It will be happening.
Hall of the PFF Hall of Very Good would include guys like Jarrell Casey, Carlos Dunlap, Gerald McCoy. He had some peaks.
Sue.
They were really good. Ndamukong Suh.
KJ Wright for the linebacker
group. Yeah. KJ Wright. Tamba Ali. Linval Joseph.
Cameron Wake is a really interesting one, actually, because he might have been the best pure pass rusher in the league for a long period of time before that group of Von Miller, et cetera, arrived and just took it over.
Yeah, Cameron Wake's career pass rush grade is higher than J.J. Watt's, right, by the way. Now, Watt, exceptional run defender. So it's a completely, you know, you can't just look at that one number. But Cameron Wake, when we're talking about career pass rush grade of these guys, 06 to 12, it's Von Miller, then Cameron Wake, to your point.
Right, and Wake's, like, I mean, his career grade wasn't helped by the last couple of years where he hung on a bit and was still the most productive pass rusher on his team. But what is that, like 6 seasons with a pass rushing grade above 90, another one of 88.6. He was, like, look at that run of pressures. It's, like, absurd. 81, 86, 71, 65. He was a truly dominant pass rusher and a guy who I just love his story where, you know, CFL wasn't wasn't a prospect, a big prospect coming into the draft, went to the CFL, got signed to the Dolphins, and then was getting outsnapped by Joey Porter, who was playing for the Dolphins at that point. And at that stage, 2009, PFF was saying, you need to take this guy, your Hall of Fame player, Joey Porter, and sit him down because the dude behind him, Cameron Wake, is destroying him in terms of pressure rate. And this was back when Joey Porter was getting like 15 sacks for the Dolphins. But it was one of those seasons where 15 sacks represented like 50% of his pressure, right? He just had a year where every pressure he got was a sack. Whereas Cameron Wake sitting behind him was just destroying people in terms of pressure rate and was beating guys to get his pressure. And then as soon as the Dolphins did scale up his use and put him out there for 900 snaps, exactly the same thing happened. Continued to be one of the most dominant pass rush forces in the NFL.
Couple more names to highlight here. Geno Atkins and Justin Houston. I think both of those guys, I don't think they're going to the Hall of Fame, right?
No.
But they might be at the high end of the PFF Hall of Fame. Geno Atkins was pre-Aaron Donald prototype.
I feel a little bit sorry for Geno Atkins because I think Aaron Donald has ruined the perception of Geno Atkins because Donald come in and just change everything.
That's what Watt did to Justin Smith. Remember? Yeah. Because Justin Smith was the guy that we were like, oh, look at PFF guy is Justin Smith. And then J.J. Watt was like a bigger, faster, stronger version of Justin Smith and destroyed everything he did.
Well, J.J. Watt completely changed our perception of like how good a player at that position could be. Geno Atkins, I think, had already done that. And Donald just came along and like was better across the board. I always use this comparison to make this point. And it's a terrible one because it's a really niche thing that about 7 people understand. But
good.
Motorcycle racing. There was
off to a good start.
Valentino Rossi, right?
Yeah.
Greatest motorcycle racer of all time. Has won God knows how many championships. Still racing despite being like 45 years old. There was a dude before Rossi came along called Max Biaggi. Max Biaggi had won like every size of bike up to the MotoGPs. I think he'd won a MotoGP title. He was the best guy around. And then Rossi rocked up. And from that point on, Max Biaggi was the second best rider in the world for the rest of his career, right? And you could tell that it drove him batshit insane. Every single race, Rossi would just hang around behind him and then like the last lap, win the race, right? Just overtake him, win. And it drove Biaggi absolutely crazy. But like there must be something truly maddening to that, to being like, any other era, I would be the best guy in the world. And I would be the guy for whom the adulation is showering down and praise would be raining from the skies. It would be glorious to be me. But right now, I'm just number 2 behind this dude who's the best in the world. That is basically Geno Atkins, right? He got a head start, but that 2012 season is still one of the best seasons we've ever seen from an interior pass rusher. Then Donald rocks up in, 2014? And from that point on, anything Geno does is just irrelevant. Like, you're really good. You had 3 straight years of double-digit sacks from the interior. Nobody cares because Aaron Donald was better.
Would you argue the same for Justin Houston, too? Because he's, as an edge, once J.J. Watt moved to the edge, okay, he's behind Watt. He's probably behind Von Miller. I think he's behind Khalil Mack.
He's behind a bunch of guys. Whereas the reason I feel sorry for Geno is because he was clearly the second best guy for a long period of time. And if you, like, again, any other era, Geno Smith probably would have been the best pass rusher in the NFL on the interior Yeah, Geno Atkins would have been the best pass rusher on the interior for a number of years in the NFL. But because he got unfortunately timed with Aaron Donald, you get you're a forgotten man.
So we're gonna have to put like an actual team together for this thing, huh?
Are we?
I think it's not today, but at some point we're gonna, now that we've named like a million players, we're gonna have to make some hard decisions.
Well, we also, I think for the, if we're gonna do an actual PFF Hall of Fame, we need to make the decision about whether, because I think we probably should include the guys that are shoe-ins for the actual Hall of Fame. The sure. reason we didn't is because it would make bad discussion for a podcast, right?
Is Joe Thomas in the PFF
right.
Hall of Fame?
Yes, he is. Yes. Next, like it's not good, right? Is Megatron a Hall of Fame player?
Yes. Are we going to send these guys, we're going to send them some busts and stuff?
I don't control that budget. You're going to have to talk to higher-ups. But I think like if we create an actual PFF Hall of Fame, clearly those guys should be on it, right?
Right. We should do that. We should figure out what that looks like.
We should shortcut the real Hall of Fame by like, what is this 5-year waiting period crap?
As soon as you announce
retirement. We have the information. You might need 5 years to get your dossier together on insert random player. We have all their information the second they retire.
Like Pete Prisco pulls out his binder of Tony right. Baselli accolades every single year. Like, let me tell you about Tony and how he's the best left tackle.
Look, this guy needs to do some research on this guy to figure out how good he actually was. We have all of their snaps in the database dating back to 06, so we can cover that the second they retire. Andrew Whitworth can have his, like, ceremony. You know, I regretfully announce that I'm walking away from the game at the age of 42 years old.
We'll, like, quote tweet it and, right. like, welcome to the PFF Hall
exactly.
of Fame.
2 seconds later, it's on Twitter. It's done.
All right. Let's do that. Let's have the PFF Hall of Fame ready to go. You know Neil's been talking about this for a while. He wants in on this.
Yeah.
So let's do it. So you got to be the whole era.
We can let him do the team and keep him busy for a whole week.
That's true. He does need stuff to do. Right? No, Neil's working hard as always. A lot going on here at PFF behind the scenes. All right, what else you got here? Anyone else? You wrote down Devin Hester too.
Yeah, which feels a little bit cheaty because you're putting him in as a return guy. But
return guys are people too.
They are.
Oh, and speaking of special teamers,
Pat McAfee.
Let's get McAfee on the show.
Hunter of the decade.
McAfee's not doing much right now. Do you think he's got some time to join the show here?
He's got his own shows.
But
if we tell him he's in the PFF Hall of Fame, we might be able to get him in. He was keen.
If we could get him in the studio, he'd probably do like a little shooting star press through the table or something.
Maybe.
That's what he does.
I don't know if we want to destroy this table with it.
I would sacrifice the table in order to have...
This isn't like one of those, you know, folding tables that the Bills guys throw themselves through. Like, this thing's got some heft
to it.
It's
not what we call a working table, Sam. Right. The working table's
gonna... I mean, I'm not saying it wouldn't snap as well. I'm just saying it might do you some more harm on the way down. Like, particularly if you look at how these legs are constructed, those are support. Those are not going away easy.
Yeah, so if...
You would go through it anyway. But it might take out a kidney on the way down.
I was thinking... some of the potential, you know, what could Steve do for the charity thing?
Go through the table?
No, I was thinking Bills-related stuff, like I'll wear a Josh Allen jersey or dress up like Josh Allen, or maybe as long as Josh Allen has a 90-plus PFF grade, like I got to rock some Allen gear. Like we'll have this like running 16-game rolling grade, and as long as he's above 90, you know,
I like
Josh
the idea
Allen.
Of you having to wear a Josh Allen jersey signing the Josh Allen apology form.
Yeah, and I'll sign, you know, so maybe that's it, right? So
that's a good one.
I think... I'd sign the form, and I can also rock Josh Allen gear. As long as his last 16 games, he's like an elite player or something like that, I'll rock an Allen jersey.
I think we just do it as that's your thing. For that show, you have to wear a Josh Allen jersey.
Sign the apology form. Let's get Bills Mafia. Bills Mafia loves to give to charity too, so let's get them involved here.
So Devin Hester, I think, and let's put in Cordarrelle Patterson as well, because that way we can solve this problem that seems to break people's brains
every time
it comes up. Devin Hester is the best punt returner in NFL history. Cordarrelle Patterson is the best kick returner.
But everybody remembers Hester kicking off, leading off, you know, the kickoff return to start the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's not saying he never scored a kickoff touchdown, but like he wasn't that good as a kickoff return guy.
They are different skill sets.
Cordarrelle Patterson is the best kick returner in NFL history. That guy is now tied, I think, right, for the most kick return touchdowns in NFL history. Will probably break it at some point in his career.
Yeah.
In an era where they've tried to basically eliminate that play from the game, right? If you look at the number of returns that Patterson has had to get that touchdown record compared with, I think, is Josh Cribbs, the guy that he's tied with? He's like a half the returns as Josh Cribbs. Like, Cordarrelle Patterson is ridiculous as a kick returner.
Yes.
Devin Hester, ridiculous as a punt returner.
All right, so there you go. It's a PFF Hall of Fame. Right now, We might go to Bobby Wagner. We might not. All right. And then we're gonna record an outro, Sam.
Yeah.
And well, I'm going to say, we may have heard from Bobby Wagner. We may not have.
And it's not even we, right? It's just me. You're not even going
to
be here.
You're going to go to it.
Yeah. So I might be going to Bobby Wagner right now, and then we will be returning.
And now we're back, either from a Bobby Wagner interview that you did, which was great.
Or just from that
fantastic.
Segue.
Fantastic. Brilliant, even.
Yeah.
Or we're just, you know, looking like idiots.
No. We just came back from the segue.
Came back from the segue. Yeah. Yeah.
It was great.
But that was a good show. Good show. Happy Thursday, everybody, because it's Thursday, Sam. Today's Thursday. It is Thursday. We're not.
Uh-huh.
It's absolutely Thursday.
There's no recording.
It's what we are. But yeah, we'll be back on Monday, because today's Thursday. We'll be back on Monday with some more great PFF NFL podcast. That's it.
Yeah.
Wave.
See ya.